This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics, and it's March break. The Ontario legislature is not in session, but Doug Ford is going a mile a minute, including a measure that's designed to help drivers get a little closer to that. And I suspect the idea of allowing single occupancy vehicles to travel in the HOV lanes in off-peak hours is the least controversial of the things he's been talking about this week. And I also suspect that a lot of the stuff he's talking about is kind of a move to say to people, look over there. Don't look at me. So here's what he had to say. He's been talking about getting more transparency from judges. He has this idea of live streaming bail hearings, which may be a good idea, although most of the evidence in bail hearings is usually covered by a publication ban, and he didn't talk about how he would get around that. But he's calling for this increasing transparency from judges as he is trying to shield himself and his cabinet from public scrutiny by tightening up the freedom of information laws. And it sort of seems to me like he's sort of saying, gee, you think I'm not transparent? What about that judge over there? And he's been explaining this bid again to shield himself and his cabinet from freedom of information requests by saying, first he's saying he's protecting us from China and Russia snooping. Then he's saying, oh, his voicemail is full of constituents calling with their deepest, darkest secrets on his voicemail, and he's protecting their privacy. Well, all of those eventualities are covered in the current legislation for exceptions to those requests. So, again, I'm not accusing him of hiding anything, but sure looks that way with this bid. Oh, and by the way, let me ask the panel and all the people out there, is it a good idea to allow citizens, regular people, to carry pepper spray in case they need to defend themselves? That's another thing that he's been talking about, and there are people who are on both sides of that argument.
And now, the Recovering Politicians panel.
And now I'd like to welcome Lisa Raitt, a former deputy leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, George Smitherman, a former Ontario health minister and deputy premier, and Peter Tabbins, a current Ontario NDP MPP for Toronto Danforth. Hello and welcome to you all. Lisa, let's begin with you. I mean, is Doug Ford just trying to get us to look away from this bid, really, to prevent the public from having a look at what he and his cabinet are up to?
Well, first of all, top of the afternoon to you.
Oh, yes, you're wearing green.
I'm wearing green. So, yes, I'm 48% Irish, Libby. Today's the day where I pretend I'm more than that. But nonetheless, on your question, I find it fascinating. I felt inundated by messages from your producer because every couple of hours there's something else that Doug Ford had announced and something else. So for me, I find it to be a lot. I don't know the motivation. I don't know if it's to distract. I do think, though, it is a tactic, and it's almost like he's leaking the speech from the throne that normally happens at the beginning of a legislature session, and getting an idea of how people are reacting to it. So he's throwing it all out there. There's going to be a lot of people talking about it. Maybe it's to divert divert attention from the privacy issues, possibly. I'm sure that's something that comes out. But I think that he's trying to get a beat on what Ontarians are thinking about. And some of the stuff is very interesting and not quite what I had anticipated we'd be talking about, given this geopolitical and financial crisis we're in.
Well, so what is the stuff that's surprising you? I mean, some of this justice adjacent stuff, that doesn't surprise me. He's on to that a lot.
Yeah, I like, so the pepper spray, I mean, the two things that came out at the same time for me was the pepper spray, meaning that he'd asked the federal government to change the laws to allow people to carry pepper spray. But at the same time, I also heard that he's thinking about allowing booze at certain public events. And I thought, pepper spray and booze don't really go together, especially at public events. And I thought that was a cross message, because that's immediately what came to my mind, the havoc that could be creative. But the booze at events, where's that coming from? And why is that needed in society, to go to a farmer's market with a beer at 6 a.m? I don't get it. But maybe it's something that people want to have.
Is it Buck a Beer Revisited? But Lisa, before I move on, since you're the only woman on our panel today, would you carry pepper spray? Is that something that appeals?
I would. I live in a condo that is on the south side of Union Station. When I walk from work, which is on the north side of Union Station, I have to go through those dark areas. I am worried, and I would carry it for my own, don't know for protection, but definitely for my own peace of mind.
Yep. Okay. George, so let's start with the pepper spray question. I know some people say allowing people to carry it will make things more dangerous because bad people will carry it. I'm assuming that bad people who want to carry it are carrying it anyway.
Yeah, that or perhaps bear spray. I do think on a matter like this and all matters that are really about personal security, I'm always deferential to women, because I realized a long, long time ago when I lived at Dundas and Sherbourne and I was trying to rent an apartment that it just had no appeal to women because of the nature of the area. So Lisa's answer stands right for me. I always thought I was a greater risk to my own personal self than anybody else, but even as a regular transit rider, etc., it's very hard to avoid circumstances in Toronto these days where behaviors really do make me even feel at some risk. So I'm actually inclined, like I said, to defer to women, but I think that's not, to me, an intensely problematic advance.
Peter, what do you think?
Well, it's an interesting question, Libby. I mean, I'm going to go back to, looks to me like Doug Ford's just trying to flood the zone with all kinds of extraneous issues. I mean, public safety is a real issue. There's no question about it. And I'd say talking about a strategy that makes people feel safer, making investments in dealing with the things that cause criminal activity makes a lot of sense. But I think he's got big problems around OSAP. He's got huge problems with this freedom of information issue. There are problems with the whole unemployment numbers, which are really quite high and really desperate for young people. So I think he's trying to divert us with all kinds of things that he's not actually particularly serious about.
As always, two equal and opposite things can be true at once. I mean, I agree that I think personal safety is a huge issue, particularly yes. Here in Toronto, where the city ain't working. So I think he's on to something there, and he's long been railing against so-called liberal judges and the whole catch and release bail thing. Though my observation is that when it comes to justice, enforcement of our laws, you have every level of government pointing the finger at the next one, Lisa.
Yep, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. The reality is that when you're thinking about what the next couple of months looks like, having people focus on themselves, on something else, may make a lot of sense, because the economy isn't that great. And that is the pocketbook issue for everybody. And I don't think it's going to get better, Libby. I think it's going to get a little bit worse. more people. And as the gas prices are going to go up even further, having people thinking about other matters, it is an effective, as I said, distraction.
Uh-huh. And, you know, Peter was saying that he thinks that freedom of information thing is a huge issue. And I wonder, I mean, it's definitely a huge issue for us, those of us who are journalists. But I don't know if the public is, sorry about that. I don't know if the public is focused on the loss of their ability to look into how the premier and his cabinet are spending their money, George.
Yeah, they're not. I agree with you.
You know, I think that, firstly, I'll just say, like, on matters related to criminal justice or what have you, Ford has never let go of the populist instinct to use that as a battering ram against the feds, even if he's thought to be Mark Carney's buddy. So he might have gone to his cottage, but the next day Ford wouldn't have slowed down on any opportunity to lay those issues at the feet of the federal government. And I think that's an approach that probably is working, working for him. I think on the FOI, I'm really kind of defer to Peter because I want to hear a little bit more about it, what it means. But I would make two points. Firstly, I think government overall keeps a lot of information to itself that has no reason to be held back from the public, that there actually is an instinct towards secrecy and keeping things confidential that actually should be in the public domain. But I was surprised when I was a cabinet minister that my briefing book that I took into question period was FOI-able. As Minister of Health, that thing had hundreds of pages, and I didn't get a chance to write all of those pages. So I was in a situation where you could FOI my book, and everything that was in there was supposed to be something that I endorsed. I eliminated that and started to go into question period with no more than 6 or 7 pages, because if I didn't know how to answer the question off the top, then I could always beg for a little bit more time. So I'm going to be on the premier's call list. If you see it there, like, I do reach out to him every once in a while, etc. I'm just not too sure about whether there are areas where a politician or an individual ought to be able to conduct themselves without that being in the full public domain. But I don't know about what other restrictions are involved in their proposed changes. So I'm interested to hear what Peter's take is on it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, it comes after, you know, he tried to stop Global News from getting access to his phone records. And suddenly he's saying, oh, all these people tell me their deepest, darkest, most private things on my cell phone, which, you know, I kind of doubt. And if they do, those things could be protected anyway. I mean, you know, journalists often complain that you get an FOI request back and a lot of it is redacted, some of it for good reason. But yeah, I think Lisa was probably onto something with, you know, seeing what sticks, Peter, because the latest thing today is that HOV lane thing. And I think given the congestion, that's right for the base.
Exactly.
If you don't mind, Libby, I don't think there's any question. Gridlock and people's frustration about not being able to get around is huge. Absolutely huge. And I don't see this government actually doing the things that are going to be needed to address that. I just don't see it. And I have to say that for Ford, distracting from the things that I'm hearing about, which is governments that aren't accountable. And George, in response to your comments, most people don't know what freedom of information requests are. They just don't. But they do know about accountability. And if they don't think that governments can be held to account, if they feel that governments can hide really critical information, that part they don't like. They just use very different language. And so I think we've got a government that's under criminal investigation. We've got a government that has fought against releasing records of who called Doug Ford, not asking what they said, not asking them to talk about their childhood trauma, just who called Doug Ford. And the fact that he's fighting so hard to stop this makes me think that there's something really bad news in there for him. I don't think he'd spend as much time on it otherwise.
That's interesting. That's interesting. But again, I don't know how people are engaged in it. And I have to make the point that it seems like all over the world and all over North America, there's a move towards less transparency. Doesn't matter what kind of government it is, what flavor of government, they seem to just want to hold on tightly. And the biggest thing is that you can't go back or go forward and sort of figure out the reasoning behind a lot of decisions, Lisa.
Yeah, no, I hear you, Libby. And maybe when I was sitting in government as a cabinet minister, I had a different point of view, right? That sometimes conversations you wanted to have with people, you wanted to not be part of the record of the Canadian government. However, now I'm outside for the last 6 years, and I see that there is no shame in people understanding, possibly after the fact, how you got to the decision. So is it a cooling off period? Is it something that you need to, you know, have a number of years before they become available to people? I don't think that the transcript of the conversation is something that is necessarily would be allowed, because you've got to get the third party confirmation that you agree to that kind of thing. But the notion that there is a call, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing to know. And as a politician, I think it's good to know that the public are watching, to be honest, because it does curb your perhaps not as altruistic abilities, or you're not as altruistic notions in terms of how to move forward. So yeah, I'm far more on the on team transparency these days, especially with the current government federally. I would like to know what's in those press readouts with Donald Trump, and I did want to know that that our CAF was under fire in Kuwait when it happened. Those are two things that I did want to know.
And oh yeah, it's you know, Ford is a progressive conservative, Carney is a liberal, and they both like to hide things. George, just getting back to the first thing we were talking about was this idea of live streaming bail hearings. And as I said, that often bail hearings are protected by publication bans. So does that have any legs, or is it just a thing that he's throwing out?
Well, he's just baiting on that issue, and that's an issue that he's that he likes. So he likes to return to it. This is just a way to freshen up his attack on, and really his attempt, I would say, to defer responsibility from what Ontario ought to be doing to the national government. So I think this is just part of a long-running political play for him, which is one of his most important differentiations with the national government. And I don't really expect anything to change on that basis. But I think it is fair to say that there are a significant number of people that do place, you know, kind of personal safety and crime issues at a very high level. I talked on here before that I'm sure the federal Liberals think they lost their first shot at a majority in York Region and Brampton, where a lot of voters in the national election a year ago cast ballots that surprised folks because they were very focused on the personal safety side of it. So I think for him, that's just his core politics, and I don't expect it to go away. I don't even know whether they take that seriously or not, or whether that's just actually a little bit of bait.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Pat in Toronto. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Libby. You know, one of the things that hit me recently was the Ontario Place deal. And if I remember correctly, it's a long-term lease, but it's with a non-resident entity. So therefore, my antenna went up, because that means it'd be very difficult to get information if there were any sort of a concern from the non-resident entity. So I throw that one out, but there is a simple solution, and I think this exists in some parts of our society, which is if you've got confidential information and you don't want to release it, you go before a judge, and the judge makes a decision as to whether that would happen. Now, I don't think Doug Ford would want to go before a judge.
No.
but I think that's one solution.
Well, yeah, you, in the current legislation, there are exceptions to it. This is one thing that I keep saying about a whole raft of things. You know, why don't we just enforce the laws we have? You know, that would make a big difference if we did that, but we don't do that.
And I have one last comment. The bail hearings, I see an opportunity for Doug Ford here. When he retires, he can become the Judge Judy of Canada.
I think he's going to have a lot of options, but frankly, I don't think that he's anywhere near retiring. So I don't think we have to think about that one, Pat. Thank you for that. You know, Lisa, you mentioned the real issue being affordability and the economy. And it's interesting, yesterday on our Zoomer Squad, talking to Anthony Quinn, who's the president of CARP, and speaking about having faith in institutions, you know, you look at the inflation numbers, the CPI index, and they've been painted, the last one is, it's good news, right? It's good news, inflation is easing, and he was saying that the inflation numbers just don't reflect the experience of people. And part of that, you know, I'll follow up with economists, is the things they put in the basket. You know, maybe that has to be changed. But our civil servants and all of that, are they just out of touch with regular folks?
Maybe. The last part to your question, maybe civil servants are out of touch because of the role they play. But I also think that it's the metrics that you can't deny is when people start, unfortunately, defaulting on mortgages, defaulting on car payments, not being able to pay their credit cards. Those stats will come out, and they'll come out separate and apart from any kind of government analysis, and it's not tied to inflation. It's tied to statistics that will be available through various other financial organizations. And I worry about it. I worry about whether people are actually able to keep their head above water, knowing that things are going to get more expensive. For example, Strait of Hormuz is closed. There's a lot of potash that goes through there, that goes to the countries from which we buy food, and there's going to be a problem with the cost of food.
There already is a problem with the cost of food.
Yeah, no, anything corn-based, corn-derived, they're wondering whether or not they're going to be able to plant a full crop of corn in the United States. That has a big impact on us and the cost, and we don't grow that much corn here.
Yeah, and there was just a Vivid Data came out yesterday with a study that said, I forget the number, sorry, but a large percentage of people are paycheck to paycheck, and they just can't afford things, Peter.
Yeah, that's entirely the case, Libby. They are very hard-pressed, and I think when it comes to cost of living, the consumer price index, inflation, different parts of inflation hit people differently. And what I hear is where people are really hurting is going to buy groceries. That is really, really tough. That may not be a major part of the way the stats are put together, but that's what people experience. And Lisa's quite correct. People are defaulting on their mortgages. We're seeing higher unemployment rates. With youth unemployment at 14%, very few youth have mortgages, but many families have young people who are working, bringing home some money that helps make things balance. And people are feeling that squeeze. Again, that's why I think we're getting a whole bunch of stuff coming forward that is sort of diverting attention from those really pressing issues that people are caught up with. They may be emotional hot buttons, but they aren't talking to actually the big things that are making people's lives really hard right now.
Okay. I just wanted to take a call from Scott in Niagara Falls. He's been waiting quite patiently. He's an ex-cop, and he wants to talk about the pepper spray. So, Scott, go ahead.
How are you?
We're good. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the pepper spray. Once you make it readily available to everybody, it will be readily available to every dirtbag in the country. It is a weapon that totally incapacitates you. So, for example, Lisa was talking about feeling safe. What if the guy took it from her? Once that pepper spray is used, you're blind. You're done. And it can be used against a cop. It can be used against a store owner. It can be used when somebody in a grocery store or a retail store is trying to arrest somebody. It just becomes another weapon for the bad guys.
Yeah. That is always a risk. Thanks for your call, Scott.
Could I just comment on inflation
absolutely.
A bit?
Yeah.
Firstly, I've been driving my car quite a bit back and forth to my cottage in the last few days, and I've heard a lot of commercials from both the federal and the provincial government that have told me everything is hunky-dory because they've reduced all kinds of costs that I'm experiencing. Well, I was feeling good about it. And then I heard last night, as the holder of a variable rate mortgage, that the inflation associated with increases in gas prices puts pause on the Bank of Canada to actually have to contemplate that to curb inflation, they will increase rates. That was sobering news to me, and I'm sure to the million other Canadians that actually have a mortgage renewal coming up. And I really agree with what Peter said, is that the food basket, maybe you could say the prices aren't increasing like they were, but everybody knows that the product size shrank. So I think that that's, you can try to convince yourself sometimes that change has occurred, that electricity prices are lower, or insurance prices are lower, or gridlock is fixed. But some of these things are very, very, even if the numbers seem to suggest it, they're impossible to make people believe it.
Yeah. On that note, I'm going to wrap things up because I think, that is the bottom line on things. And I was saying with the inflation numbers, like, whoopee, beef, instead of going up 20% year over year, is only up 14%. I mean, and it wasn't good news if you're a vegetarian either.
No.
Exactly. Okay. Thanks, guys. Interesting conversation.
Thanks,
none of these things are going away. So bye-bye. Lisa Raitt, Peter Tabbins, and George Smitherman. We'll talk again soon.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, in the last segment, we talked about the Premier's outrage at some of the decisions from inside the justice system. And here's one that's really resonating with the larger community. 65-year-old Darren Scott Ray, who was convicted of raping and murdering a 14-year-old boy in 1987, has recently been on an unescorted pass, and he will get two more of these passes for absences from prison. Now, in a decision just came down in January, the Parole Board of Canada stated that he was granted a 72-hour pass earlier this month to visit a community-based residential facility in Oshawa, and that he has now two more passes like that. And the idea is to, quote, support a gradual reintegration process. And that decision by the parole board prompted Durham Regional Police to issue a community safety alert. So they're not convinced that this guy is all rehabilitated. So people, what do you think? 866-740-4740. That's the text line, the long distance phone line, Toronto phone line, 416-360-0740. And I guess the question at the bottom of that, you know, are there some crimes that are just simply unrehabbable, unforgivable? Why are we even trying to get this guy back into the community? And now I would like to go to Ari Goldhind, who is a criminal defense lawyer. Hi, Ari.
It'd be great to be with you.
Thank you. So you're a defense lawyer. You defend,
people just like this.
So how do you see this?
So I think this is actually a more interesting story for the reasons that the public is not aware of. First of all, let's answer your question, unless you were asking it rhetorically. Yes, there are kinds of crimes and subsections of criminals that, in my view, do something so heinous and so ghastly that they forfeit the right to live the rest of their life amongst civilized society. But, Libby, that answer only applies if you're in the United States. If you're in Canada, it doesn't apply. Because Canada has now tilted the balance and has over the last number of decades much more in the interests of the accused. And in some ways that's good, in some ways it's not, much more than the community of the victims. You talked in your earlier segment about Doug Ford going on about bail and the justice system. We don't have enough time before you have to pay some commercial bills to talk about that. But that is really where the tension is. Let's talk about this man. This man was released on a 72-hour pass to go from one facility to the next facility that he's going to move to as part of his journey to increased freedom. Now, is there a high risk that he will reoffend while out for those 72 hours? There is not. Did this crime occur 40 years ago? And there is a theory for these kinds of crimes called burnout. And now all of your audience is going to know what I'm going to say. There is a reason when you watch golf on the weekend, every ad is for a pharmaceutical, half of them for Viagra. You're not the same person, and I'm being serious here, it's a theory called burnout. It's not me making this up. That as your testosterone goes down from your 20s, you're not the same person, including violent sexual offending, that you are in your 60s. However, what's concerning about this man is the kind of offending he did, where you don't necessarily need your genitals, I'm being less graphic than I would normally be, to commit this kind of offending when you have pedophilic interests or interest in young boys. So while he is certainly still a high risk, he has done what he's supposed to do in jail to increase his freedom. Here's the part of the story that the public doesn't know and I think has been underreported, which is so much of what this man has done has been his own self-reporting. I'm a good boy. I'm not interested in boys anymore. Oh, yes, I'm not interested in them anymore. When I get stressed, I smudge. This is him now turning to his indigenous roots. And what the parole board found while granting him this unescorted leave is that he doesn't have great insight and, in fact, minimizes what he did to that boy. And the problem I have is the second he starts doing that, and not understanding what he did to that boy and explaining in a way, and the boy consented to being with me and it was consensual. That to me is, I'm being serious, Libby. That to me is the part of the story that has been underreported. And here's why I think it's underreported. I'm not saying he shouldn't be able to go to this facility. I'm not even saying he shouldn't be out on that pass. But Libby, we have six security guards sitting in a courtroom for every trial I do. When the jury comes in, there's six, there's eight, there's 12 people that bring prisoners to court every day for stupid appearances that they don't need to be there. If this guy is a danger and the parole board is saying he minimizes what he's doing, he's sort of an apologist for himself. They couldn't rustle up some kind of federal bureaucrat to schlep him in the car. That to me is the problem with the story, not the result. But I'm a big believer that there's a difference between what an inmate tells you and what the reality is. And when you have a predilection for young people or boys, burnout, the theory that I told you about a moment ago, doesn't subside the same way that violent offending does.
Let me jump in.
So
my question wasn't about jurisdiction when I asked, are there some things that are unforgivable? I mean that.
I didn't answer jurisdiction. It was
okay,
a good question.
So that was one thing. But, you know, if the parole board itself said this guy minimizes his own crimes, why are they giving him unescorted passes?
Their answer is because with the passage of time, his indigenous roots, his cooperation in the jail, his lack of being a high risk, they believe, and here's a line from their report, Libby, I'm going to paraphrase, but it was quite a shocking line, that even if he reoffends while he's out, it's not going to be the kind of reoffending that's serious. I'm being serious.
Okay, Libby. Were they specific? Like, what is not serious?
That's the question, is that if you're saying if he reoffends, it's not the kind of crime that's going to get the public going bananas. That was a strange statement to me because I don't know what that meant. But again, there's nothing wrong with the parole board.
He killed a little boy and put the body in a trash can.
And that's why, Libby, I didn't poo-poo your first question, which you said with some rhetorical flourish, and I think is a probably more important part of the discussion that we never have, particularly in this country, which is, are there the certain kinds of crimes that are so heinous that you just forfeit your right to come back? And the Supreme Court, as you and I have talked about, Libby, which your listeners should know, the Supreme Court have said absolutely not. Ari is wrong. Libby is wrong. Everybody deserves a chance at bail, even if you kill 10 people. That, to me, is a very big difference between us and our friends to the south that we thumb our noses at. But to me, Libby, if there isn't some kind of category of you do something that's so grotesque or horrible that you just forfeit your right to walk down the street next to Libby and her listeners, I don't know. That doesn't seem too controversial to me.
Okay, and the other side of that question that other people have started to ask, we know that Indigenous people are overrepresented in the justice system, but are people getting lighter sentences, easier terms and conditions when they invoke Indigenous status or whatever?
So that's a two-part question. Let me break it up. The word overrepresented, I think, is a debate and a discussion that is completely never had. I think that word is misused, and I think it's a longer discussion than you and I can have, so I won't have it here, but I'm not somebody who simply goes along with that word, okay? I don't think the police go out arresting people because they're Indigenous, or because they're a minority, or because they're a majority. They go out and arrest people who have committed crimes. Your second question is a much easier one. And there's a great writer for the National Post, who I'm sure you know, who does great work on this, named Jamie Sarkonic. And I can tell you, Libby, absolutely 100%. And the Supreme Court will tell you this, by the way. The sentences are lighter should you be able to invoke an Indigenous background or even self-identify. There is no question, and this is in the law, it's codified, it's called GLADU, there's great reporting on this, the Supreme Court has written about it, you absolutely get a lesser sentence in this country frequently if you are either Indigenous or a member of what's called a racialized minority.
You know what? We're basically out of time, and there's a lot to unpack there. Ari, thanks for your insight on this. I'm going to end with a call that we have, but really appreciate your views on this. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
Okay, let's take a quick call from Daryl in Toronto. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. I'm wondering, why can't we make judges and parole boards people responsible if someone they let out commits another crime? That might temper their judgment as to, rather than just that they're letting them out on the unsuspecting public, but that they would be responsible too.
Okay, good question. Thank you, Daryl. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, I don't know if this is related or not, but do you have difficult people in your life? Well, there is research, scientific research, that now says, well, the difficult people in your life, they are actually physically aging you. We will talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, do you have difficult people in your life? Well, who doesn't? And if you sometimes feel like they are making you tear your hair out and making you get older, sorry about those alerts, well, you are right. Research funded by the U.S. National Institute on Aging reveals that HASSLers, difficult people who cause chronic stress, can accelerate biological aging, and they've even quantified it. They said that each Hassler increases your biological aging by 1.5% for each toxic relationship, and this amounts to about 9 months of extra biological age. And the work finds that these often unavoidable relationships, either with family members, coworkers, neighbors, trigger inflammation and health decline. So we'd like to hear from you about this. Again, the text line, long distance phone line, 866-740-4740, or our phone line, 416-360-0740. And now I am joined by Dr. Oren Amate, who is a registered psychologist. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Thanks as always, Libby.
So what do you make of this? I was actually surprised that this research was done by a U.S. government agency.
Well, okay, I'm not surprised at the results, let's say, because as social animals, you know, our most prevalent and the most damaging stressors on average are other people. It's our relationships. And, you know, all the research shows that the majority of work that psychologists and psychotherapists do has to do with, you know, let's say, interpersonal dynamics, relationships. And I don't think there's ever been a time when I haven't had to discuss the necessity of healthy boundaries. And this research is really showing that if you don't have those boundaries, you are going to suffer. You're going to be stressed out. Your cortisol is going to be, you know, pumping out. And in the end, it's going to age you prematurely, as you were mentioning.
So how do you get to have healthy boundaries if these relationships are unavoidable?
And that's the problem, because, you know, the research showed that one of the more vulnerable groups of people are people with more adverse childhood events. So these are people who, you know, may have been abused, may have been neglected, you know, had very, you know, early difficulties. So from an early age, you know, when they didn't have the ability really to set healthy boundaries, their rights were being violated. You know, their sense of well-being was being affected negatively constantly. So unfortunately, it's harder for such people to do that, but it's not impossible. So what do? You have to, I mean, it depends, because they were talking about, let's say, roommates, colleagues, family members, right? Each different type of relationship brings its own problems. And so how do you set boundaries? Well, you know, the first step is having that discussion, feeling that you have the right, feeling that you have the self-agency to say to somebody, you know what, this isn't working so well, or when you do this, you know, it has this impact on me. It's trying to do that. And unfortunately, in many cases, it's not going to turn out, and you have to find a way to sort of distance yourself from them, which, to your point, is really difficult when you're in a forced relationship, like at work.
Like at work, but what if it's your child?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, I have many, many patients who I have to help them learn how to put those boundaries, and it's really difficult. So, you know, whether it's a child, like, a, you know, a young child or an adult child, you know, it's being able to say, this is what needs to happen without feeling unnecessary or neurotic guilt. That's really important. And recognizing it's for the good for both of you, because if your child, for example, doesn't learn how to relate to others in a way that doesn't stress them out and age them prematurely, they're going to have difficulties in all types of relationships. So it's convincing yourself that this needs to be done for both you and the other person.
So do you have a sense of how many Hasslers do most people have in their lives?
Well, okay. I mean, according to the research, I think it was around maybe about 10% or so on average. You know, I have a biased sample. People are coming to me for a reason. So I would say, you know, a lot of my patients have 2 to 3 times that number of Hasslers. So, you know, but it's also very subjective, because, you know, what one person would consider a Hassler, another person would just be consider an annoying friend or something like that. And if you have good boundaries, it doesn't have the same impact. So I would say that at least, I think everybody has at least a handful, if not more, of Hasslers.
Right. Okay. So everybody has a Hassler. What about this idea that they've actually quantified the biological aging? How did they do that, and is that really something we should pay attention to?
Well, A, it's above my pay grade because it's the they're doing epigenetics, but at least they're doing it in some supposed scientific manner. So they take saliva and they look at your cortisol levels and they have some other biometrics that they're able to look at. And again, I could bluff it and try to describe it, but quite frankly, it's, I'm just reading it like reading a car manual. I sort of understand the words, but I don't understand the science behind it. So they're trying that, but we have to be very careful because this kind of research, once it becomes quote unquote sex, like research on oxytocin became really sexy and people started misusing it and started making some ridiculous claims. So I think it's a worthy endeavor, but we have to be very cautious in interpreting the results.
Okay. If each Hassler, and you say people have a handful, increases your biological aging by 9 months. So again, what does that mean? If my actual age is 50, but I have a handful of people each increasing my biological age by 9 months, so what does that make me, 55? And I'm not saying those are my numbers. Is that what it, amounts to?
Well, in theory, yes. And I mean, these are only averages. I mean, they're saying 9 months. So, but that's like with smoking as well. When they say if you smoke a pack of cigarettes, you're taking off this many days or, weeks of your life for each pack. So it's only a rough estimate. And I just use these as guidelines. I wouldn't take them as hard science because it's not like they were tracking them and then, going up all the way to death and going, you see, we predicted it right. That's not going to happen. These are not longitudinal studies yet. So we don't know if it's going to play out the way that they're saying. But they are looking, they're comparing them to other people with fewer stressors. And they're looking at their biological age. They're looking at other co-founding variables and controlling them and saying all else being equal, they do show indications that they are prematurely aging. So again, it's not a really hard science, but it's a type of science.
Okay, but what is the bottom line on this? Are these people going to die sooner or what?
In theory, yes. And I'm telling you right now, I tell this to my patients all the time. I say, what do you think is the number one killer of everybody? And it's stress. Whether it causes, exacerbates, prolongs, or maintains, like a physical or psychological condition. And we know psychological conditions take a physical toll. So overall, yes, every time you're pumping out cortisol, every time you're having a stress response, you are aging yourself. Now, it's not going to be like every time you do it, it's 1 year off your life. But the more stress the more uncontrolled stress that you experience, the greater the risk that you are going to suffer from some debilitating condition, or you're going to die prematurely, quite frankly. So, yes, I would say that's the bottom line.
Okay. So you try to help people put boundaries. But again, I mean, if it's your kid and you worry about your child, how does it work?
Well, again, depending on the age of the child, but I always say, especially if they're not an adult yet, I always tell the person, our goal as parents ultimately is to make sure that our kids can be independent one day, self-reliant. So I always tell them that's the messaging that you have to give. I know you don't like this. I know you don't appreciate this. But if you don't do this, okay, or if you continue to act this particular way, you are going to have difficulty, whether it's maintaining a job because you can't get along with your boss and colleagues, whether it's having a partner. We do know having a partner helps, prolong aging if it's a healthy partner. Okay, so, it's basically telling the kid that this is for your own good. Will the child listen to you and appreciate you? No. But the more that you do it, the more that you get that narrative out there, eventually you hope the child will internalize it. And you're going to have lots and lots of fights. You have to be consistent and you can't give in to guilt or shame or fear. You have to be able to say, this is for my child's best interest. That's my job as a parent.
What about if it is a parent that's stressing you out?
And that's okay. And I right now, currently, I have so many patients who are in that situation, especially the sandwich generation, right? They're dealing with their own children and an older parent. And I say, and they, when they hear boundaries, they think I'm saying to cut off the parent and they start having this reaction. I say, no. A boundary doesn't have to be a barrier. A boundary is just letting your parent know, hey, you know what? I'm an adult now. You know, I have the right to do this, to think this way, to be able to be free from your encroaching on my, you know, on my well-being. You have that right to say it, and you put those boundaries out there. You do it respectfully, and if the parent violates it, then you have to create some distance with them, and you say that, not just ghosting them or cutting them off, but letting them know, you know what, hey, I think for the sake of our relationship, maybe we need a bit of time away, or, you know, just give me a few weeks or something like that, or I'm going through some health conditions. These are the things you have to try to do. Does it work? And most times not, but the thing is, I try to help people at least go to bed at night saying, I took the high road. I tried everything to make this relationship work. And if it doesn't work, if it goes sideways, at least you don't take on the unnecessary guilt. Because guess what? You know what neurotic guilt causes? Stress. You know what stress does? It kills you.
Okay. We only have a few seconds left, so we can't get into that because, you know, I have a lot of people who are dealing with parents who are suffering with dementia, which is not something they can control, and that causes a lot of stress. But we're going to have to revisit this conversation, which I think is a very interesting one. So anything you want to leave us with in 10 seconds, 15 seconds, Oren?
I will tell you, I have a number of patients who are taking care of people with dementia or Alzheimer's or other debilitating conditions, and I tell them they're angels, okay? They're not putting them in homes. They're taking care of them. I say, you know, you're an angel, but you're also suffering. And so I do think it's a worthy discussion to have, and if you want to have me back on, I would look forward to having that discussion. It's so difficult and heartbreaking.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Oren Amate. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, a lot of things in today's show that we will have to revisit. So tomorrow's Wednesday. It's a day for our medical panel, plus whatever else we take on. I'll be back here, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.